Welcome to Night School. I'm Becca.
And I'm Claire. We're a student-run podcast bringing you monthly doses of the medieval world.
Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're joined by Dr. Hartley Lacter to discuss medieval Kabbalah. Dr. Lacter holds the Philip and Muriel Berman Chair in Jewish Studies and serves as a director of the Berman Center for Jewish Studies and the chair of the Department of Religious Studies at Lehigh University. His scholarship focuses on medieval Kabbalah with a particular emphasis on the relationship between Jewish historical experiences and the development of Kabbalistic discourses. His work explores how medieval Jewish-Christian debates, as well as disruptive moments of violence and forced conversion, shaped Jewish mystical literature, which in turn served as a form of cultural resistance for pre-modern Jews. He is the author of Kabbalistic Revolution, Reimagining Judaism in Medieval Spain, published by Rutgers University Press in 2014.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I guess we'll just dive right into the first question. So we were kind of wondering, just to get off on a more general start, we were wondering, where does medieval Kabbalah fit within the larger tradition of Jewish mysticism? And how do the questions Kabbalistic discourse seeks to address relate to efforts to, in your quotes, construct an empowered Jewish identity?
The most distinctive feature of medieval Jewish mysticism, or what comes to be known as Kabbalah, is the embrace of the doctrine that there are 10 emanations or luminous entities known as sfirot that comprise the mystery of divine unity, an expanded paradox of the Trinity, a divine that is at once 10 and 1, and that this emanates from the endless source of the divine essence, the Ein Sof, the endless, and it emanates down through these 10 sfirot and then into the world. That symbolic structure is a kind of important development in medieval Jewishism, starting in late 12th, early 13th century in Provence and then into Spain. The first known, what's often regarded as the earliest Kabbalistic book, Sefer HaBahir, originates there. But really over the course of the 13th century, Kabbalah proliferates in the Iberian Peninsula, especially in Catalonia and Castile. There are other forms of Kabbalah that, such as Abraham Abulafia, represents an engagement also with mystical techniques, the use of divine names, a focus on divine names, and the Hebrew letters of the divine name. These are also important aspects of Jewish mystical tradition that we find sometimes, for instance, the mid-12th to mid-13th century, the German pietists, known as the Hasidei Ashkenaz, they don't embrace the doctrine of the 10 sfirot in quite the same way, but they have these other sort of features of Jewish mysticism. But what we call Kabbalah, and what most Kabbalists call Kabbalah, at least the larger portion of it, is what they call theosophic Kabbalah, because it has this symbolic structure. It's based on an interpretation of a neologism that appears, this sort of new phrase that appears in a text from somewhere from antiquity. Its origin is debated, but known as Sefer Yetzirah, or the Book of Creation. And the Sefer Yetzirah talks about the creation of the world through the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet and the 10 sfirot blima. So it's not clear what that means. It's not entirely clear what sfirot, which is the plural of sfira, means, and what it means for them to be blima. But it's often taken as the ineffable sfirot, and that there are 10 of them, and together with the 22 letters, these are the 32 wondrous paths of wisdom with which the world was created. This is claimed to be a secret doctrine, meaning it was something passed on secretly, and what is ultimately claimed in 13th century Kabbalah and later is that this was an oral tradition revealed by God to Moses on Mount Sinai and then passed on orally from master to disciple. And there clearly were esoteric trends in medieval Kabbalah where there were ideas that were kept secret and passed on in sort of closed circles. But I think it would be a mistake to take that to mean that Kabbalah was something that very few people knew about, at least in its general form. I think over the course of the 13th century and then certainly into the 14th and 15th century, Kabbalah becomes really broadly accepted and canonized as, for many Jews, the sort of the central inner core of what Judaism is. And its basic the basic tenet of Theosophic Kabbalah is that the world emanates from the mysterious infinite God Ein Sof through the 10 Sefirot, then creates reality as we know it, and that the way that reality is maintained is through the practice of Judaism by embodied Jews in the world. Since Judaism very much is a religion more of the body rather than purely of the mind or of matters of faith, it's very focused on matters of practice. And Kabbalists argue that when Jews practice Judaism in their embodied form in the world, they draw divine blessing or energy called Shefa down from Ein Sof through the Sefirot and into the world. And that we refer to this as theurgy, this notion that these human actions impact the divine realm, was a powerful suggestion of the power of Judaism, even in circumstances of historical disempowerment, that Jews are secretly the heroic entities that literally sustain the fabric of the cosmos itself. It was a way to read the purpose of the practice of Judaism as having this effect, sustaining reality and seeking to correct the flaws with the things that are not right in the world, that there is this process of tikkun, which means both rectification and adornment, that Jews accomplish through the practice of Jewish law in their embodied state. And over the course of the 14th and 15th centuries, there developed a kind of complicated notion about the history of the cosmos and its various manifestations or forms, and the suggestion that in the current manifestation, there are serious flaws in the world that need to be corrected, even flaws within the unity of God's inner self that need to be corrected, and that Jewish historical suffering is an important secret part of this process of pushing history forward to its final rectification, in which there will be a reversal of the fortune of the Jewish people that will be a signifier of the correction of the state of the universe. So this both historical disempowerment of Jews and through their practice of Jewish law, that the suggestion is that they are really the vital force in history, though not appreciated as such, and that their just life and their historical traumas collectively and historical setbacks are actually markers of their central importance in the world and the vital task that they perform both on behalf of divine unity and on behalf of the being of the universe itself.
Great. Thank you so much. That was really helpful context. Just to kind of set up our discussion today on some aspects of your research, how Kabbalistic texts constructed and empowered Jewish identity, and also the aspects of gender that are related. So we wanted to ask you a question about your article, Jewish Bodies in Divine Form. So in this article, you talk about how Christian polemical and medical texts denigrated Jewish men and attacked their alleged spiritual deficiency by feminizing them. Could you explain a little more about how these shared conceptions about, you know, the female body or gendered readings of, you know, what they believe impure blood, how these ideas in medieval Christianity and also some overlap in the Jewish tradition, how these informed 13th and 14th century anti-Semitic portrayals, and then also the subsequent Kabbalistic narrative contestations?
Yeah, so the scholars have noted that there is a convergence of misogyny and anti-Semitism in some forms of Christian discourse about Jews, and in particular that Jewish men are both feminine and that they have ailments that are signifiers of the killing of Christ. So one is that they have a monthly bloody discharge or flux that is often associated in the medical literature. Sometimes it was just claimed that Jewish men menstruate, but in more popular discourse in medical literature, it was depicted as a kind of distinctive Jewish hemorrhoidal ailment. But that this was a form of seeking to encode in Jewish bodies a form of the notion of the doctrine of the witness, the old Augustinian idea that Jews suffer through the course of history. They live as a disempowered and dispersed minority in order to demonstrate the truth of Christianity and serve as a cautionary tale for those who would reject the Christian message. Augustine says they're very useful for Christians as they seek to convert non-Christian communities because they can claim both that Jews demonstrate the truth of the Old Testament upon which the New Testament is based, but also that Jews show what happens to those who reject the message of Christ, that they live as a disempowered, you know, the wandering Jew image of the dispersed minority, so that Jewish punishment and affliction is a sign of their having fallen from divine favor and should be helpful to Christians to convert non-Christians, which Augustine said is the reason why it is acceptable for Jews to live as a minority within Christian societies and not to be forcibly converted to Christianity. They can be persuaded, but not forcibly converted. The development in the 13th century and onward with a much sharper form of Christian anti-Jewish proselytization and anti-Jewish discourse generally was that Jews really do have these ailments in their bodies, especially Jewish men have these ailments in their bodies that are a further sign of having betrayed Christ, a further sign that they have fallen from divine favor and are no longer the carriers of the covenant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but that has passed on now to those who are the followers of Christ, and that the Jews have now sort of become this enemy of the divine. Kabbalists really do invert that image, that of course they claim that Jews are the only people truly derived from God. They claim that Jews have a divine soul, which makes them incarnate in a sense, in almost a Christ-like way, except unlike the singular incarnation of Christ, they claim that all Jews, or at least all Jewish males, carry that distinction. And Kabbalah was also a very androcentric doctrine. My advisor at NYU, Elliot Wilson, he did a lot of work on the ways in which the gender imagery of the Sefirot does have a pronounced androcentrism and phallocentrism, by which I mean the 10 Sefirot are actually depicted as gendered entities with a kind of relational gender. The Sefirot that are higher up are more male. They refer to gender as being in the form of overflowing and receiving, mashpia u'mekabel in Hebrew. And the Sefirot that are overflowing onto the Sefirot below them, they are male in relation to the Sefirot below them, but then somewhat female in relation to the Sefirot above them. It's a relational type of gender, but that the interconnection between them has this gendered and erotic character to it. The full assimilation of or reunification of the 10 Sefirot involves the reunification of male and female aspects of the divine that's understood as a kind of crowning. And it's one where the feminine is like the crown that sits upon the head of the masculine. This is the return of the divine, feminine divine presence or Shekhinah to the male entities of the Sefirot. And that this is a reunification that involves the creation of what, again, this isn't my unique scholarship here, but what my advisor referred to as Elliot Wilson calls the male androgyne, that is the sort of androgynous but still male divine in the sort of redeemed or reunified state of the Sefirot. That would imply, therefore, that Kabbalists, by helping to bring about this process, they are agents in this reunification, and therefore they are sort of decidedly male in their role, in this theurgic role, and that they have the capacity to be reassimilated into this spherotic structure in a way that non-Jews do not. So the male Jewish self has this sort of male role to play that I think does counter in a lot of ways the notion of the Jewish body, at least the Jewish male body, is being feminized. And also the implication in the notion of male menstruation is not just that it's feminized, but also that it is defiled. And in the Kabbalistic vision, it's sort of the counter-theological opposite to that, in which the male body performing Jewish law is actually the most distinctly sacred of all bodies, the one with the most powerful religious agency, and the one that is working to recreate the male divine self through the integration of the feminine aspect into the male whole.
So moving away a little bit from the bodily and gendered readings, we were kind of wondering, how did Kabbalistic understandings of the soul confer divine powers, which are reserved only for Christ in the Christian tradition, to all Jewish men?
Well, the thing to that's really interesting about medieval Kabbalah is that it does something that we don't find in prior forms of Jewish discourse about the soul, especially in rabbinic literature, like the text of the Talmud, in that the soul is seen, and this really starts in the 13th century, the soul is regarded as co-substantial with the divine. It really is an emanation of the divine, a spark of the divine, that is embodied, rendered incarnate within the flesh of the Jewish self. And that this is what Kabbalists argue, that is what enables them to have such powerful theurgic capacity through the performance of Jewish law by observing the laws around kosher food, the celebration of the Sabbath, holidays, daily prayer, all of these things that are done physically. And also, of course, through observing laws around marriage and procreation. While celibacy and monastic culture was developing in Christian culture, in rabbinic culture, it's not permitted for a man to choose not to be married and to choose not to have children. And so this mandate was understood as part of how Jews perpetuate and sustain the cosmos is through the propagation of more embodied Jewish souls in the world. That continuation of the cosmic process through this embodied form is an expression of a kind of incarnational theology, but it's one that's very different from Christology, which would suggest that the unique and singular incarnation of the divine self into the divine son was part of a redemptive process for the universe. This is sort of rendered more democratically across the entire, that all Jewish selves are in fact more Christ-like than Christ. It's another type, I would suggest, of counter-theological inversion, a move of that sort that Kabbalists perform in the construction of an empowered sense of the Jewish self, and also in a kind of rejection of Christian claims about Jewish disempowerment and Christian claims about unique Christian forms of empowerment and about the unique nature of Christ and central Christian theological claims are all in many ways suggested as being false through their manifestation in as opposites within the Kabbalistic worldview. So there is a really important formulation of Christianity and Judaism that's happening in the Middle Ages through this polemic encounter between Judaism and Christianity. And I think Kabbalah does reflect the sort of theological politics that are at work in the Middle Ages, in which Jews are a shared voice in this very complicated, really fascinating cosmopolitan and diverse culture that was developed in many locales throughout the 13th through 15th centuries. Often Jews are kind of overlooked when thinking about even when thinking about things like categories of race, categories of anti-Semitism, often Jewish voices are regarded as somehow irretrievable. They're absent from these conversations. I think it's actually really interesting that you asked someone who studies medieval Hebrew Kabbalah literature to a Kabbalistic literature to come and be on a podcast that's about the Middle Ages. Sometimes people who study medieval Jewish texts aren't always placed in the same category as medievalists. But I think that these texts do reflect a culture in which these kinds of questions were being worked out, often through the construction of discourses that are the opposite of the opponent of the competing claims. And for medieval Jews, they couldn't afford to ignore competing claims that were directly suggesting that Judaism was no longer the religion of the covenant of the Old Testament, or that Jewish bodies are defiled, that the practice of Jewish law is outmoded and no longer necessary, that Jews sort of are stuck in a previous incarnation of history and have missed the opportunity through the embrace of Christ to move forward in history. And they're now suffering historically because they are attached to an outmoded form of religiosity. These were claims that Jews had to think about, and that Kabbalah reflects an engagement with them. And often it involves a sort of the embrace of the notion that Jews are the opposite of the thing that is being claimed about them in Christian polemical discourse.
And another aspect we kind of wanted to explore as you mentioned earlier, the Ten Sefirot are gendered entities, as you said. So could you talk a little bit about the role of the feminine presence in these emanations, kind of what role it plays in Kabbalistic texts, or also some of the symbolism or imagery used to express them?
I'm interested in the historical context in which these kinds of claims about gender play out. The actual gender symbolism of Kabbalistic literature, other scholars have written about this, so I certainly can't claim any exclusive originality there. But what is very interesting about medieval claims about gender and the use of feminine imagery is that the lowest of the ten sefirot, and therefore the most feminine because it is the most receptive from the upper sefirot, the divine presence or Shekhinah, they use this Hebrew biblical word, but it takes on a new theosophic connotation in medieval Kabbalah. One of the founding myths of, or central myths of medieval Kabbalah is the notion that the Shekhinah is dislocated from the ten sefirot, that there's a rupture within the sefirotic system, and that the Shekhinah accompanies the people of Israel in their exile, and that the attempt through the theurgic operation of the observance of Jewish law by Jews to reunite the sefirot will involve in this kind of return of the feminine aspect to the masculine aspect, a kind of reunification of the husband and wife, and the central male entity, Tiferet, the sixth sefirah, often depicted as the central one in many of the visual depictions that develop in medieval Kabbalistic manuscripts, that this reunification is brought about through the Jewish observance of Jewish law, and that it's reflected also in the historical experiences of the Jewish people, that exile and diaspora is something that affects not only Jewish humans in the material world, it also is reflected in a process happening in the divine realm, and that the Shekhinah accompanies the people of Israel, that the return of the people of Israel to their ancestral land, or the return of the Jewish soul to its origin in the divine realm, also entails a reunification of these aspects of the divine. I don't think we can see this as a feminist discourse because it still is largely androcentric in its gender construction. It involves the notion that divine wholeness entails a re-assimilation of the feminine female aspect into the male self, in which the female is an aspect of the completed male. But it was one that used gender in this very interesting way, and used it as a way of reading Jewish historical experience writ large.
You write about how some Kabbalists re-envisioned Jewish persecution within the context of historical oppression as a form of redemptive suffering. How does this connect to the agency that Kabbalistic discourse attributes to the divine soul while simultaneously serving as a, quote, counter-historical and counter-theological response to anti-Semitic Christian polemical writings?
So this is research that I'm doing right now for a book. A tentative title is Inversions of History. And I'm interested in the way that Kabbalists understood the meaning of Jewish historical experience. This was something, as I mentioned before, they couldn't not think about. It was so central to Christian claims to be inheritors of the covenant, the Old Testament covenant. It was so central to Christian claims about the manifest and obvious fall from grace that Jews have experienced as the chosen people. Why are they so dispersed? Why are Christians, and Jews would note Muslims as well, why are they so much more empowered with so much more autonomy and agency, and Jews live as the politically disempowered residents of Christian or Muslim kingdoms in the Middle Ages? Jews could not afford not to think about this. So they had to construct some sort of schema of understanding what is happening in the broader world historical process, and what are the theological implications of this for covenantal theology. If the notion is that Jews have a covenant with God in which, through the performance of Jewish law, the contractual mutual agreement is that God will protect the Jewish people, give them peace, security, and return them to their ancestral land where they will be as the Bible says, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, and the return of the Israelite kingdoms this appears not to be happening. And waiting for the Messiah, Jews are noting in the 13th and 14th and 15th centuries that the Messiah is not arriving. And they had to ask the question, what is happening in history? And Kabbalists were very, very interested in this question. And their notion of the theurgic power of the practice of Judaism was really central to that, and also the divinity of the soul. What they start to do, though, in particular, we see this in 14th and 15th century texts. And as you, in many of your other interviews, have noted the importance of manuscript work for the study of anything in the Middle Ages. And this is certainly the case in Kabbalah as well. A lot of things are not published. So working with manuscripts is really important. Many medieval theosophic Kabbalistic texts talk about the nature of the historical process in a really complicated way. They argue that just as in the Bible, it talks about the practice of the sabbatical year, that every seventh year one's lands are to lay fallow, debts are forgiven, and that every seven sabbatical cycles, so after 49 years, after seven cycles of 7 years, there is the Jubilee, where everyone returns to their ancestral land that was divided among families and clans with the settlement of Canaan, that there's something special about that type of that particular period. So the notion that no one could ever be sort of, that this is a time of return. No one would ever be permanently, no family dispossessed of their ancestral possession. Kabbalists say this involves there's a secret true meaning to this, which is that it's about the age of the universe itself, and that the world manifests in cycles of 7,000 years, and that each one is referred to, it's a sabbatical, in Hebrew it's called a Shemitah. So each Shemitah is actually its own world. And it's governed by, each Shemitah is governed by one of the seven lower Sfirot. They had this idea that the upper three Sfirot were very, very, these were very transcendent, but that the seven lower Sfirot correspond to the 7 days of the week. They correspond to these seven cycles of sabbatical years. And then after 49,000 years, the universe returns to its origin in the upper divine feminine entity called Binah, or the divine mother, and would be sort of annihilated there. Some Kabbalists say that cycle then restarts itself again. Others just don't really comment on what happens at that point. In each of these cycles of 7 years, as each one is governed, each world, each Shemitah is governed by its own Sfirah, and therefore will take on the characteristic of that Sfirah. And different Sfirot have different natures to them. And what they argue is that the previous world, the one right before this one, they claim to know where humans are in the current temporal map. The previous one was governed by the Sfirah of Chesed, or loving kindness, and that was a pretty perfect world. The world was comprised of divine light. It wasn't embodied. There was no sinfulness. There was really no history in the sense that we know it, that the the world was really perfect. However, this is the Sfirah of Din, or this world is governed by the Sfirah of Din, or harsh divine judgment. And it is because of that, that accounts for why the world is filled with so many problems. And especially since the transgression of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, the world was really set off course. It almost had a correction with the giving of the Torah on Mount Sinai to sort of remove the impurities of the snake from the Garden of Eden. But that then when the children of Israel constructed the golden calf, they destroyed that opportunity and the world is now filled with strife. And they argue that these transgressions have a historical consequence in that it causes the external entities. They argue that the Sfirot actually has sort of external powers associated with it that govern the Gentile nations of the world, and that these nations are empowered through their sort of heavenly ministers that oversee them. And this is why Jewish people are disempowered in the world and non-Jewish entities are empowered. The only way to get history back on track and to then sort of bring this very unfortunate Shemitah, they argue we live in the worst of all possible worlds, to bring the Shemitah to an end is that Jewish souls need to encounter historical suffering at the hands of Gentile entities in order to refine the impurities out of their soul. They see it as a kind of history is a refining crucible for Jewish souls, and that this has to take place over a long duration. And they embrace as a result of that the doctrine of reincarnation, that these divine Jewish souls, they actually manifest in all of the different worlds. But in the current world, until this world is destroyed and the next world is created in the next Shemitah of 7,000 years, the Jewish soul is needs to undergo this process of refinement and purification. And that explains why historical suffering, as Kabbalists see it, is not a setback. It's actually a sign that Jews are fulfilling their responsibility to move history forward. And in fact, as the world becomes more filled with strife, they argue that this is a sign of the beginning of the end, that as the powers that govern Gentile nations and enable them to overpower Jews, God's chosen people, that as those powers are waning, they actually function with more force as they are sort of in the final pangs of their historical moment. And this is what then allows the last forceful push of historical suffering for Jewish souls in order to become refined and to be reassimilated into God, and in order to then usher in the Messianic era in which the Jewish historical fortunes will be completely reversed. There will be an inversion in which non-Jewish, the dominance of Gentile peoples will be ended. Jews will somehow become the most dominant people on earth. World peace will reign. There will be a kind of messianic era. And then the world will be reassimilated into the upper Sfira, Binah. And then the next world that will be created will be governed by the Sfira of Tiferet, which will be a really perfect world in which what we think of as historical process won't really take shape. And they suggest to Jewish readers that the difficult moments that they're encountering, right? This is in the wake of, you have the expulsion from England in 1290, France in 1306. Then there's all sorts of terrible things in 1391, about 100,000 Jews are killed on the Iberian Peninsula, especially in the region of Castile, in mass violence against Jews. We want to avoid the lachrymose approach to Jewish history. It's also the case that Jews were really focused on understanding the theological meaning of the perception of Jewish historical decline. And Kabbalists suggest that this actually is not only an ennobling form of suffering, it is the thing that helps move history to its final culmination and its reversal. And the Jewish souls that reincarnate through in Jewish bodies over the course of the history of this particular Shemitah, of this world, are helping to accomplish that process.
To kind of wrap up, we were wondering if you could share a little bit about, you know, some of the other questions perhaps that medieval scholars or Judaic studies experts like yourself who engage with these texts are asking today that most interest you.
There's a lot of really great work being done by people today on the way that the Jewish-Christian debate is reflected in Kabbalistic texts. And some scholars are doing very interesting, cutting-edge work looking at often neglected Christian texts in Latin and other languages that are doing analogous things to what we're seeing in Kabbalah, and really thinking about the ways that these texts sort of reflect each other, echo each other, and without giving into a kind of simplistic notion that there's what I call the contagion model of the spread of ideas, which is that it starts over here and then it's adopted by people over there as though it spreads through a process of contagion, but rather that it reflects a really complicated, interconnected culture in which the theological discourses that are developed and recorded in texts from what we think of as different religious communities being written in different languages actually do show a common cultural engagement with certain types of ideas. I think that that kind of work is really exciting. The work that also situates Kabbalistic ideas within history, enabling us to study Kabbalah, not as just a way of studying like Kabbalah as though it's just an idea that kind of floats above history, but looking at Kabbalistic texts as a way of studying people. I'm really interested in that, and a lot of people are doing some very interesting work in that arena. There's also interesting work that's being done now in medieval studies is interested in this question of race and to what extent we can think about race operating in the pre-modern context. It's constructed, so of course this construct functions differently in different historical moments, but that there clearly does seem to be a type of state-sponsored, the application of state power in a way that disenfranchises or oppresses people based on difference that was understood as being bodily. And that Jews are often the sort of primary pre-modern test case for this. And that the ways that Christian majorities thought about Jews then was also reflected onto other types of others. And that Jews are sort of the constant internal other within medieval Christian society. And there's been some really interesting work that has been done. This is a very current question in the field about race operating in the Middle Ages. And often race is a Christian category for how they thought about Jews and how Jews were treated by the government is something that scholars are grappling with today. But there's a dearth of thinking about Jewish voices in that conversation. And in fact, in what ways Jews may be engaged in their own form of othering and their own form of race making, even if they lacked the capacity to have that be reflected in any kind of autonomous government policy, because they didn't have the capacity to apply power in that way. But Kabbalah does reflect some really interesting forms of pre-modern race making in its own way. And so in what ways are minority voices part of that conversation, and how does that help us fill out our picture, our understanding of medieval cultures? So I guess in general, scholarship that looks at the wide array of Kabbalistic texts, and there really is an enormous body of texts that have been produced both in print and of course in manuscript, that helps us get a sense of what does this tell us? How does this add to the tapestry of medieval culture more broadly? How does that help us see how there was a diverse chorus of voices and of peoples that were comprising medieval culture? It wasn't just Christian voices, or somehow that Christian voices and Jewish voices, Muslim voices and others were operating in isolation from one another, but that there was really a lot of sort of intertwined culture, domains in which these identities interacted with each other and overlapped. And Kabbalah it helps us gain purchase on some aspect of the medieval world in that way.
Okay, well, I think that's all the time we have today. Thank you to our listeners, and thank you for joining us today to talk about Kabbalistic discourse and everything else that you're researching. We really appreciated having you on.
Thanks so much for having me.